You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Ethiopia jails three opposition politicians and a journalist. We'll ponder what it is that Prime Minister Meles Zenawi dislikes about democracy. We'll meet the politician with the fabulously grand title of MP for Northern Europe, Axel Lemaire, recently elected representative of one of France's new constituencies of expats.
Most of the French who live here in the UK don't get to elect an MP, which is why I usually present this new election as an improvement.
We'll talk to DJ and curator Giles Peterson about the one-day festival he's hosting in London tomorrow. We'll consider Sharia-compliant vacation options, and we'll have a chat with our editor, Santiago Tarditi, and play a song or two as well. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before we set about all that, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The Syrian National Council leader has said that the Syrian opposition is sending a delegate to New York to call on the United Nations Security Council to hold an urgent meeting in the wake of a reported massacre in the Syrian village of Tremsha. Up to 220 people were killed there. The UN's Major General, Robert Mood, has confirmed that fighting did take place in the area.
We can verify continuous fighting yesterday in the area of Tremsha. This involved mechanized units, indirect fire, as well as helicopters. UNSMIS stands ready to go in and seek verification of facts if and when there is a credible ceasefire.
20 Ethiopians, including a prominent blogger, journalist and opposition figures, have been jailed for between 8 years to life today on charges of conspiring with rebels to topple the government. Blogger and journalist Eskinder Neger, who was arrested last year and accused of trying to incite violence with a series of online articles, was jailed for 18 years. His lawyer said he would appeal.
In my personal opinion, we rebutted prosecution evidence beyond reasonable doubt.
Some good news now for Italy, as its three-year borrowing costs ease well below 5% at a bond auction. The Eurozone's third-largest economy passed a tough market test after Moody's cut its sovereign rating to just two notches above junk status. James McKenzie, Reuters' chief correspondent, was surprised by the success of the sale.
We had a relatively successful auction, a bit of a surprise after Moody's downgraded Italy by two notches overnight. They sold all the bonds they wanted to sell. They're still paying a lot for to place their bonds, but it wasn't the sort of the bloodbath that might have been expected after the Moody's.
The Chelsea and former England football captain John Terry has been found not guilty of racially abusing fellow player Anton Ferdinand after a five-day case which cast a spotlight on racism in the game and could have had a huge impact on his career. The chairman of Chelsea, Bruce Buck, was relieved with the verdict.
Let me just say a few very brief words. Chelsea Football Club notes, and of course we respect the decision of the magistrate today. We are pleased that John can now put his mind to football and go back to training and do what he's done for many years. That's really all I have to say. No questions. Thank you.
Burma has charged at least three UN staff during a period of unrest in Rakhine province, the United Nations has said today. All three are all Burmese nationals working for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, said the workers were among 10 UN and international NGO workers arrested.
We would like to be informed of what they are accused of and that we would like to have access to them. Nobody is above the law, but we are very keen on making sure that all our staff is respectful of the laws of the country. We don't know exactly what they are accused of, and that is the reason why we have asked for that knowledge to be given to us and for access to be granted to us.
And finally, prisoners here in the UK have been given a guide to the great outdoors with a list of animals to watch out for. This month's Inside Time magazine, which is delivered free to all jails in the UK, features pictures of 11 creatures commonly seen in the summer, including the willow warbler and the pipistrelle bat. The guide, written by an inmate in a Leicestershire prison, has been criticised by other prisoners who say they are locked up without any chance of seeing the natural world, apart from mice or cockroaches in their jails. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's coming up for 6 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, és Tokyo. Ez a Monocle 24.
Velkommen til Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρέσε, Monocle 24.
Λοντόστε Καζίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, ez a Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρέσε, Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, sino Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está fazendo com o Monocle 24?
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você escuta o Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você escuta o Monocle 24.
Escuta o Monocle 24.
Você é o Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Um, a Monocle 24, Hagat, já.
This is Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller. Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi fancies himself as a forward-thinking moderniser and certainly takes pains to project such an image abroad. Back home, however, his rule is what might charitably be described as old school. An Ethiopian court today jailed three opposition politicians for life and one journalist for 18 years after convicting them of links to an organisation called Ginbot 7, described by itself as a pro-democracy movement and by Ethiopia's government as terrorists. Joining me now is Ben Rawlins from Human Rights Watch. Good evening, Ben.
Hi, good evening.
These sentences handed down today, are they intended to be exemplary or will these people actually do the time?
Well, obviously we hope it's the former. It might end up being the latter. I think that depends more on the longevity of the regime itself. There have been plenty of examples of harsh sentences in recent years, so I don't think there's a need for any more.
Either way, though, the Ethiopian government is clearly intending to send a message. To whom are they trying to send it, and what is that message?
They're trying to send a tough message to anybody that opposes the regime, to anybody that speaks out, that criticizes the regime in blogs and newspapers, as Eskinder Nega and several other journalists who were convicted of terrorism and jailed earlier this year and last year have also been doing. And they are intending to pretty much shut down all legitimate opposition to the regime.
I mean, what is Meles Zenawi scared of? Is he that unpopular that permitting dissent and political plurality would bring about the end of his government?
Well, nobody knows, and I think least of all him. And the fact that he deems such acts necessary is really a sign of weakness rather than a sign of strength. His international friends are fond of portraying him as a strong leader and Ethiopia as a strong and stable country. I think that's a bit of a fiction. I think for the last 21 years, the government's become increasingly marginalised, increasingly reliant on a small ethnic minority and a small group of cronies. And I think it's running scared. I mean, there are a long-running insurgency in the south of the country. There's widespread opposition from the Oromo majority in the country and also now from a large number of Muslims who are objecting to the government's attempts to run the faith in the country according to the state's own people that it favours.
Well, back in another life, Meles Zenawi was a guerrilla leader who helped overthrow a previous unpleasant and repressive government in Ethiopia, the singularly ghastly Derg, who ruled between 1974 and 1987. Is his government approaching the stage which it's comparable, or is he not that bad yet?
Well, it's always hard to draw comparisons, but I think the important point is that Ethiopia is well past the pale. It's among the most repressive regimes on the African continent, perhaps among the world. In the last decade, more journalists have fled Ethiopia than any other country. It's got hundreds of political prisoners, torture's widespread, its armed forces stand accused of war crimes in its own country and also across the border in Somalia. And, you know, accountability is a very rare thing in Ethiopia. And yet, international donors are very, very keen to queue up to provide money to the regime, almost with no strings attached.
Well, and Mr. Zanawi is clearly very confident of their ongoing support. Why is that? Why does he sort of feel that he can behave like this without getting pulled up by any of the donors that keep his government in power?
Well, for the last nigh on 10 years, the Ethiopian government has been getting more and more repressive. And at every turn, the international community has kept quiet. And that's particularly so since 2005, when they briefly suspended aid after a bloody election, but then rapidly ramped it up again. And I think the short answer is that international donors need Ethiopia more than he needs them. They've got to find places to spend their money. They've got to have partners in Africa who appear to be delivering economic growth. And Ethiopia is one of a dwindling number of examples that can be held up as a success.
Is there much in the way of organized opposition to his government, though? I know there was the so-called Becker, Amharic word for enough, campaign in 2011. Did that have any lasting effect on anything?
No, because it was very rapidly shut down. The government has a vice-like grip on society. People are rightly terrified. There are close to 700,000 or 800,000 employees of the Ethiopian Secret Service who monitor every street, every household. Everybody knows that they're being watched all the time. As you may have heard, Skype is criminalized in Ethiopia. Since the leaders of the opposition parties, the former ones, have mostly been either rounded up, jailed, intimidated, or kicked out of the country, there's very little organized opposition. And therefore, and this is actually what creates a strategic danger for the country, is that without political guidance, who knows where that anger and frustration will explode.
This organization that the four men jailed today were accused of associating with Ginbot 7, are they by any stretch of the definition actually terrorists?
I think it's pretty fair to say that no, they're not. Eskinder Nego is a friend of mine. He was a very well-known journalist and blogger who actually has a green card for the United States. He spent a lot of time studying there. He could have left and gone to the U.S. at any time. He made a point of staying in Ethiopia, running a publishing house and a newspaper. He was in jail several times before. His son was actually born in jail. His wife was also jailed. So he has a long history of trying to inculcate a culture of free expression and peaceful dissent in Ethiopia. And by putting him in jail, I think the regime has sent a very strong message that it doesn't care. It doesn't care what people think. It doesn't care what the international community might say. It's pretty confident that it can rely on its creditors to keep paying the bills. And Meles Zenawi can keep clinging to power.
It can only be hoped that they've attracted more attention to themselves than they've bargained for. Ben Rawlins from Human Rights Watch, thank you very much for joining me. Coming up next, we'll chat with France's new MP for Northern Europe, who popped into Midori House a bit earlier today. Stay with us.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Most democracies extend the right to vote, with variable limitations, to their citizens who choose to live elsewhere. French expatriates, however, now have the opportunity to vote directly for a representative in their National Assembly. Before this year's parliamentary elections, France created 11 constituencies for French citizens living abroad, including Northern Europe, for French people living in Ireland, Scandinavia, the Baltic states, and here in the UK. The first occupant of that seat is the Socialist Party, Axelle Lemaire, born and raised in Canada and long resident in London. She visited Midori House earlier today, and I began by asking what kind of issues she'd found herself facing in her first months in the job.
It varies a lot depending on the type of expatriate. You can be a retired teacher living in the north of England, and then your concern will be, if I want to move back to France, how will I get signed up with the social security again, how my retirement plans are going to be recognized, how will I get to see my grandchildren who will keep living in another country. And if you're a French banker living in or working in the city, you're concerned about taxation. If you're a parent living in Finland, you want your child to keep speaking French, you'll be looking to send him or her in a French school. So the range of concerns is very large, which also makes the job very interesting, but also very difficult, because there's not one single answer to one single question.
Are there clear lines of demarcation between what you do and what the actual members of parliament representing the local governments where these people live do? Because all your constituents as citizens of Europe outside France would have their own members of parliament in the country where they live.
Well, no, except if they are citizens of the country where they live, because they don't. For example, French citizens who live in the United Kingdom don't get to vote for an MP here. It is reserved to British citizens, or actually to Commonwealth citizens. So the funny thing is that I myself, as a Canadian citizen, because I was born in Canada, I get to vote for a British MP in the House of Commons, but I'm an exception. Most of the French who live here in the UK or in any other country in Northern Europe don't get to elect an MP, which is why I usually present this new election as an improvement, a democratic improvement, because it gives the right to vote to people who were prevented from voting just because they were living in another country.
But is there ever any sort of conflict involved in practicing constituency or domestic politics on foreign territory? Your native Canada, for example, wasn't mm-hmm. terrifically happy about ballot boxes being placed in public places for the last French election.
Well, again, they were an exception. It's the only country in the entire world that got reluctant on allowing these elections to happen. I don't see any conflict at all, because I do represent the French people, and I will talk in the National Assembly on behalf of the French people as a nation, and I don't get involved in anything relating to, for example, British politics or local politics. My job is to look at the French budget, at the French money being spent on the diplomatic networks, on the consulars, on the French schools, the French cultural institutes, but also issues that not necessarily relate to the French people living abroad. But if I can bring a different view, if I can bring my experience of someone who's spent, you know, the majority of my life abroad, and I do have a different opinion on major issues being discussed in the National Assembly because of that, then I think that also brings something to French political life. So it's not only about specific issues or concerns, it's also about more general political opinions. And let me just give you an example. We will soon discuss the right to vote in local elections to be granted to foreign citizens. Should they be allowed to vote? Non-EU citizens, because EU citizens already have that right to vote. Should they be allowed to vote or not? They pay their taxes. They send their kids to the local schools. They have a job in France. I think, in my view, they should, because they simply participate in the local life and they should be granted that democratic right. And I myself, as a foreigner living in a foreign country, I can see the advantage of it and the interest of it. And that's what I'm going to say in the National Assembly.
Well, this is the age-old no taxation without representation argument. But do your constituents who live outside France still pay taxes to France? Does France still tax expatriates in the way that, say, the United States does?
No, it doesn't. There's no what we could call a sort of universal taxation depending on the nationality. It is a complex question, but basically French citizens get taxed when they have revenues or when they live in France. So it's more territorial than national. But then apparently they contribute to up to 500 billion euros to the French budget by paying taxes on incomes earned in France or on properties owned in France or any other kind of earnings or revenues. They still, I mean, they do live abroad, but they still pay, some of them still pay taxes to the French government.
I mean, as you say, it is a complex question. I speak myself as an expatriate of my own country. I'm Australian and I live in Britain, which weirdly now means I'm allowed vote in Britain, which seems to me fair enough because this is where I pay tax, but I'm not allowed vote in Australia because after you've lived outside Australia for a certain time, they kick you off the electoral rolls, which is really weird when you consider the people in Australia, the vote's compulsory. But that's just me. But as you say, it is a complex question. And are these new constituencies for French expatriates, are they universally popular in France? Or has there been a certain amount of grumbling to the extent, well, these people chose to leave, they don't pay taxes here. And that's the choice. That's the option you make. Why should they be represented?
Yeah, I mean, of course, this is an argument that I get to hear all the time. And I think it's very important to explain why these MPs will help France in general in hopefully enriching the political debate, and also explaining that it's not necessarily because you're paying tax that you have or don't have a right to vote. Half of the French who live in France actually don't pay taxes. Can you imagine, you know, withdrawing the right to vote? They don't pay taxes because they don't earn enough money, so they're not allowed to vote. That also means that if you get social benefits, for example, you cost more to the state in a way. So if you cost more, you should be paying more taxes. I mean, it's the link, the relationship between elections, taxations. It's not, we don't say in France taxation without representation. It's not linked. It's more trying, this new election was about trying to create a citizenship link or a democratic link between a state, a nation and its citizens wherever they live. So I think it's a very progressive form of democracy. It means that if you choose to live in another country, you still belong to your original nation, and you can at the same time be a citizen of another nation.
I mean, it does seem a practical response in some respects to what is clearly an increasingly mobile and fluid world where people will have different careers in different countries. Is it something that you think there should be more of? Should there, for example, be an MP at Westminster representing British people who live in France and Spain?
Well, that's a question to ask to the British government. Apparently, there are between 7 and 8 million Brits living abroad. So compared with the 2.5 million French, it is a larger diaspora. And certainly the British government would try to consider how these people would be likely to vote. Do the Brits living in Spain or Australia or South Africa, would they vote Conservative or Labour? And depending on their answer, they would probably decide or not to create these constituencies. In my opinion, it's a very good idea. I'm not sure that all governments are ready to take that step further, because it's something they can't really control. And I'm a living example of it, because this constituency in Northern Europe was created by the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, and he really had in mind the idea that it would be won by his party. And amongst the 11 constituencies created for the French who live abroad, 8 seats were actually won by the left.
And just finally, I guess, this idea, and I was talking earlier about whether it might appeal to Britain to start having MPs representing its expatriate populations overseas, is there a danger that if it spreads, and I can imagine this idea appealing to certain sections of Britain, that if the idea spreads, it could start to make an institution like the European Parliament, which really nobody in this country pays any attention to at all, seem somewhat redundant?
Well, I suppose if a federalist, like someone who has a very high opinion of Europe, would say this is a sort of intermediary step between national parliament and the European Parliament, and it's because we don't get to elect single MPs for Europe that we have this sort of middle stage of MPs representing their citizens who live abroad, their country of origin. That's how I see it. I really don't think we're ready to go any further in the European construction at the moment. But that doesn't mean that we have to deny their political rights to the citizens who live within the European area. So, but then I'm not in my role to comment on what the British government or British people would like to do about that situation. But I do think it's quite an improvement politically and democratically speaking.
As a French and Canadian citizen of Britain, what do you make of Britain's somewhat resurgent Europhobia just at the moment?
I'm quite concerned about it. To me, it is so obvious that the rest of Europe needs the UK just as much as the UK needs Europe, and in particular France. If you look at the figures from a commercial point of view, the extent of trading with the continent is huge. The UK trades more with Belgium than with India. So we're completely interdependent. And as Europeans, we're clearly stronger together than we don't live in the 19th century any longer. So Britain and France together are stronger than by themselves.
And that was Axel Lemaire, France's MP for Northern Europe, speaking to me earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And every day on Midori House, we issue a summons to one of Monocle magazine's section editors and ask them what they're up to. It's Friday, which means edits editor Santiago Tarditi. This week, he's been hard at work cultivating an appreciation of Macedonian plonk.
So they have a high acidity, very soft tannins, and a lot of berry flavors. I think this is a wine that is part of a new trend. You know, the wine industry is somehow very, very similar to the fashion industry. There are the big players, the traditional ones, Spain, France, Germany. And then there are the younger players, Australia or New Zealand or South Africa. And every year there's a new trend. And I think this year it's Macedonian wines.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, because I can remember a few years ago when Australian wine suddenly became very, very popular in the United Kingdom, having been the staple of jokes for years.
Exactly,
people seemed to think it was funny by definition that Australians would try to make wine. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out that people really liked it. And then, yes, there was that burst in popularity for Argentinian, Chilean and South African ones. The Balkan one does seem, or a sort of a Balkan popularity does seem overdue, though, because they do make very, very good wines. And I'm fortunate in having travelled in that part of the world a lot. But they do have their own particular grape varietals as well, which aren't grown anywhere else.
Yeah, well, there are some indigenous grapes like the Vranić, the Traminić, and the Zilavka. I'm talking about the Macedonian grapes that I'm sure we will be seeing lining the shelves of the big supermarkets very soon. And as you said a minute ago, they will be competing against their already popular neighbors like Bulgaria or Croatia, who have made a name for themselves. If you take into account, for example, grapes like the Zinfandel grape from Croatia is now grown in California, and it's one of the most popular types of wine in the United States.
Except it's almost now exclusively associated with California.
Exactly.
Croatia needs to reclaim that.
Yeah, but who knows? Maybe in the future we'll see some of these varietals moving around the world, and with the help of wine consultants. I imagine Michel Roland is very interested in these up-and-coming grapes. We will get very good wines because this is an industry that still needs to explore, to perfect, and to enhance their local trade. But as I said, with the help of these wine consultants, I'm sure that it's possible to arrive to a very good bottle of wine.
Do you think it's important for a relatively small and relatively young country like Macedonia that wines like this can also serve as an ambassador for the country in the world?
Definitely, definitely. I've talked about this before. The soft power of a country comes of very high importance from the food and the drink sector. Italy did it with pasta and pizza. The French did it with their bread and pastries. And for a country that is still in the shadow, like Macedonia, so to say, this is a great opportunity to show themselves to the world and to show what they can offer.
And how do you think they can go about differentiating themselves from other Balkan countries, which are already a little more established?
Well, I think the branding of the bottles has to be very interesting, because if you approach the wine shelf and you've never tried this wine, you have the eye is very important. The sight is very important when it comes to picking a bottle of wine. I have to say that I've chosen wines just because they have an interesting label. The result is not always what is expected, but it's still interesting. It catches your eye when you see a nice label. So I think label is very, very important. Macedonia, for example, has a beautiful flag, a reddish flag with like a sun in it. So I would definitely use that flag to brand a couple of bottles. And then when it comes to the taste, some people say that the person to please is Robert Parker. And people have trained all their lives to know what Robert Parker likes. So I know that these people will find a niche in countries like Macedonia. We'll go there and perfect this wine in order to get a good rating, a high score in Robert Parker's tests.
And that was Santiago Tarditi, Monocle's Acting Edits Editor. And these are the latest headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. The Syrian opposition is sending a delegate to New York to call on the United Nations Security Council to hold an urgent meeting in the wake of a reported massacre in the Syrian village of Tremsha. It's believed up to 220 people there were killed. 20 Ethiopians, including a prominent blogger, journalist and opposition figures, have been jailed for between 8 years to life today on charges of conspiring with rebels to topple the Ethiopian government. Italy's three-year borrowing costs ease well below the 5% at a bond auction. The Eurozone's third-largest economy passed a tough market test after Moody's cut its sovereign rating to just two notches above junk status. Here, the Chelsea and former England football captain John Terry has been found not guilty of racially abusing a fellow player, Anton Ferdinand, after a five-day case which cast a spotlight on racism in football and could have had a huge impact on his career. And Burma has charged at least three UN staff during a period of unrest in Rakhine province, the United Nations has said today. All three are Burmese nationals working for the UN refugee agency UNHCR. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Well, here in the UK, it hasn't been the greatest of festival seasons, although the incessant rain did at least force the cancellation of the Stock Aitken Waterman Hit Factory reunion, so the clouds hanging over Britain this summer haven't been entirely devoid of silver lining. However, DJ and label boss Giles Patterson is undaunted. Tomorrow, he presents the one-day festival Traction in Granary Square in London, and he joins me now. Good evening, Giles.
Good evening, how are you?
Very well. First and foremost, is it indoors?
It certainly isn't, but hopefully we'll get some of that Macedonian wine.
Well, tell us a bit first about the venue, Granary Square, which is a reasonably new addition to London.
Yeah, it's just behind King's Cross Station. It's just been created alongside... it's actually where Bagley's used to be, an old sort of... rave venue. There was lots of sort of old warehouses there, and they've been all taken down more or less, and they've just created a whole new space, which is wonderful, really beautiful. We're the first people to be able to put on a live event there. So it's all concrete. There's a few fountains, but we might get them from above instead of from below this time. But apparently the weather's going to be good tomorrow, well, certainly in the afternoon and the evening. So, yeah, I'm very excited to be able to host the first sort of public event there as such. We've got a terrific lineup.
Well, who are your headliners tomorrow?
Well, we've got, because it's something I'm doing alongside Eurostar, what we've done is we've sort of aimed to work with sort of music from different destinations where Eurostar goes. So we've got music from France, and Belgium, of course, and the more recent additions. We're going to Germany with music from Cologne and Amsterdam. So we've got a group called Benny Sings from Amsterdam, who are very excellent. If you like sort of artists like Michael Franks from the sort of 70s, there's kind of a twist on that, a bit of electronics thrown in. We've got a three-piece, but they're actually expanded for us for tomorrow from Germany. They sort of do a sort of craftwork, electronic sort of for now type of music. They're called Brand Brow Frick, and they're going to be doing a collaboration with a brilliant British multi-instrumentalist and singer called Jamie Liddell. We've got an MC stroke poet, rapper from the UK called Ghost Poet, who's actually signed to my label, who was nominated for a Mercury Prize last year. And we have a brilliant sort of African-influenced, out of the Congo, living in Brussels, MC singer called Bologi with his band. So, you know, and from France, I can't forget that, sort of our headliner is, particularly as it's the 14th of July.
It is, it's Bastille Day.
We've got the Bastille Day and all that. We've got the quite radical post-Jacques Brel meets Daft Punk all-rounder called Sébastien Tellier, who actually, represented France in the Eurovision a few years ago. You might remember that, I don't know, but he's a great artist. So, yeah, it's bound to be a very exciting day tomorrow.
And what non-musical attractions do you have? Looking over the bill of fare advertised online, I'm intrigued by the idea of a pedal-powered peep show.
Yeah, so am I. I haven't yet seen that. Apparently, it's one of the they've held it back from me. So we'll see tomorrow. But there's plenty of good stuff. You know, nitrogen ice cream. There's going to be some great food from all around the world. There's going to be sort of all kinds of sort of visual activities going on. It's a pretty sort of 360 degree festival on your doorstep, really. The fact that there's not going to be any grass there means you can leave your Wellington boots at home.
On that subject, do you think that, it's always struck me as absurd, even though I've lived in this country for a long time, that Britain or British people ever try to do anything outdoors. I've never understood how the English invented cricket, you know, a game that relies on 5 days of good weather. Do you think this summer, which has been appalling, will cast a permanent dampener, if you like, on the English festival spirit?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think the big festivals will always survive because they survive on quality music and entertainment, and I think that the Brits are so sort of into that culture of going out and enjoying music and arts in that way, they'll always sort of find themselves going to the sort of high-end events such as Glastonbury, such as Bestival, and Latitude. I don't think those festivals are going to suffer, but I think it's the kind of the festivals that have come along as part of the sort of festival hype, shall we say, which might not be in it for the right reasons necessarily. And so as I'd say that it's a little bit like when dance music exploded suddenly, you know, every town in England had a super club, and then after about 3 years they realized that it was just a phase. I mean, I think festivals will evidently carry on because it kind of comes from here in a way, going back, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. Or I don't know, that's actually probably a discussion in its own right on Monocle. But I think that, you know, the leaders will certainly stay. I mean, I've just come back. I do a festival every year, but I do my own festival in the south of France in a town called Sète, which is near Montpellier, which we just got back from on Tuesday. And that's, in my opinion, you know, if you're going to do a week-long festival, I'd say go somewhere warm.
I couldn't agree more. What sort of crowd are you anticipating tomorrow?
Anticipating a big multicultural, you know, crowd. I mean, it's obviously, you know, the sort of dawn of the Olympics, and you know, there's a lot of anticipation and excitement in the air. People are beginning to arrive in the country, and you know, we've sold a whole heap of tickets, so it's going to be a wonderful day tomorrow. I'm sure of it.
Well, I hope the sun smiles on you, and indeed on the rest of us. It would make a nice change. Giles Peterson, curator of tomorrow's Traction Festival at Granary Square near King's Cross in London. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Olympics are coming to London and to Monocle 24. From the 27th of July and throughout the Games, we'll be going faster, higher and stronger, bringing some of the icons of the Games into Midori House, as well as taking Midori House out on the road with a series of special shows from across the city. Monocle 24, keeping a sporting eye and an ear on the Olympics.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Planning a holiday in the sun can't be altogether easy for the religiously observant. God, after all, doesn't take time off, at least not since that first Sunday after he created the heavens and earth and so on, and can therefore be expected to maintain his constant vigilance as you hit the resort and its resident temptations. A compromise gaining popularity in Turkey especially is the notion of the halal holiday, a vacation structured to allow the acquisition of a sun tan of sorts while maintaining fealty to Quranic strictures. The so-called family-style halal hotels are alcohol-free and maintain gender-divided swimming pools, beaches and discos. Well, joining us now is Teoman Juman of the International Birch University in Sarajevo, author of an academic study of Turkey's halal tourism. Teoman, how big a thing are they? How many people are going on these?
Right now, I would say that altogether 10% of Turkey's tourism potential is maybe coming from halal tourism. Roughly, I mean, it's a growing market. My findings show that right about 6% of Turkish tourism supply is designed for halal tourism market.
Is this something that's gone on for a very long time, or has there been a real resurgence or a real uptick in recent years?
There are two types of halal tourism in Turkey. One is coastal tourism, sea, sun and sand tourism, and the other one is the hot spa tourism. Hot spa tourism is a cultural thing in Turkey, and it has been going on for long years, you know. But in terms of coastal tourism, it's fairly new. In terms of mass tourism, it maybe we can say that it's about a decade. It has been a decade that it was, you know, started and started to grow fast.
Explain to us, if you can, what a halal holiday is actually like. Do they take place in specific resorts where all these rules are observed?
Halal resorts are established in certain places in Turkey. They can be found in remote areas. On the same time, they can be found in crowded touristic areas. But the main thing is that these resorts are governed, managed in a specific way. Some of the resorts are designed in this way. Separation of men and women, separation of facilities for genders, and also the facilities are, organized, prepared according to Islamic principles.
Do these hotels and these resorts, are they established in Turkish holiday resorts, which are also popular with secular Turks and holidaying foreigners, or do they tend to be in more out-of-the-way places?
My research shows that a majority of these resorts are located in Antalya region, which is the most popular touristic area in Turkey. They are everywhere. They can be found basically in populous tourism resorts in Turkey, like Antalya, Alanya, and southern, beaches.
And what kind of activities might take place on a halal holiday?
Usually, the main halal demand is coming from women, women, before these establishments, facilities, women were, they didn't have such opportunities to go on holiday and, benefit from sea and the environment there. But after these facilities, basically, the separate pools for women, basically, women can benefit from these pools. They can dress according to their religious beliefs. And on the same time, in the beach areas, basically there is a certain dress code. And families can spend time together in a more relaxed environment.
Do you think this is indicative of an increasing Islamization of Turkish society?
It's not more Islamization, but it's more of the conservative Muslims are more apparent in every part of Turkey now in coastal areas. Basically, there are facilities that is catered to these tourists, and they go and utilize these facilities. There is certain reason for this actually. Because of the change in political climate in Turkey, more investments are coming from conservative Muslims, and on the same time, more conservative Muslims are participating in such services.
Tioman Duman of International Birch University in Sarajevo, thank you very much for your time this evening. It's 13 minutes to the top of the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And this is a song you may or may not hear on your halal holiday, depending on the tenor of the particular resort you attend. This is Turkish pop veteran Tarkan with Ask. That was Ask by Taka, and the time is 18:52 here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
Londonból, ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です. De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Londres, sino Monaco 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Λοντόστα, τämä on Monaco 24.
Londra'dan, burası Monaco 24.
London から, Monaco 24.
Finally tonight on Midori House, it's Meet the Neighbours, wherein one of our staff ventures out into the streets of Marylebone to talk to one of the best local businesses. Today we check out the Providores, a veteran around here. Lodged in a southern corner of Marylebone High Street, the chic restaurant has been catering to the neighbourhood for more than a decade. As the restaurant unveils plans to showcase paintings from young talents on their first floor dining room and to boost their wine nights hosted by boutique producers, Monocle's Anna Franca spoke to co-owner Michael McGrath.
My name is Michael McGrath, and I'm one of the two owners, along with Peter Gordon, of the Providores and Tap Room in Marylebone High Street. We've been here now 11 years. It's our 11th birthday in August on the 15th. We've got two distinct floors here. We've got a really fantastic cafe wine bar on the ground floor, which is the Tap Room, and upstairs on the first floor we have the Providores dining room, which is a slightly more serious dining room, if you like. And we're open 7 days a week, and it's really busy all the time, thank goodness. And at the moment we're just thinking about what's going to happen with the Olympics, actually, because we're not sure, nobody is really sure around here what is going to happen. But up to now, 11 years, we've been doing really well, and I'm hoping that, you know, service and food remains pretty constant all the time. Popularly, it's kind of known as fusion food, but I don't think any of us here actually like that term. It's from America, from several years ago, from a chef who was describing his food. I prefer to call it Peter Gordon's food. Peter Gordon is, as I say, my business partner and also the executive chef here and at Coop Upper, our Covent Garden branch. And the food is really his style of food, which is getting ingredients from around the world and creating new dishes, new recipes. And he's been doing that since he was 23, when he was studying in Australia, and he's done it ever since. And it's his specific style. And I always think that, you know, you always want to sort of pigeonhole these things, but it's really impossible to pigeonhole them because it's just his style of food. And he does it really well. And thank goodness, because our chefs, head chef Selin at Coop Upper and Carl here at Providores are really amazing at keeping his sort of torch burning as far as the food goes, as well as trying to be creative themselves. And it's really just lots of lovely food made up from different ingredients. What I love is that it still has an extraordinary village feel, and I'm sure everybody will say this, but it does, and it's situated between, you know, Marylebone Road and Oxford Street in a way. But it still managed to retain its village feel. I think that is due to the De Warden estate and the planning there, because they've got some beautiful shops. There is such a range of places here and that exist. From now, we've got the most beautiful clothes shops, we've got food shops, delis, cosmetic shops, I mean, everything. And it's just an amazing place. And it's stretching out now around down into other streets around. It's not just Marylebone High Street. It's we've got all sorts of other areas that are really coming up hard and fast, you know, like down Blandford Street, and around the corner from Manchester Street there's all these lovely clothes shops and things, like Trunk, which is a favourite of mine, to be honest. But no, there's lots of great things happening here. Well, my favourite at the moment is because in the evening we do a different kind of menu. We do a kind of tasting menu, which is smaller dishes, and you can have either 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dishes. My favourite dish at the moment is actually heirloom tomato goat's curd salad, which has got this most delicious olive oil jelly on it, which is just incredible. It's olive oil and Pedro Jimenez sherry jelly. It is delicious, and it's the freshest, most lovely summer meal. And I have that constantly. So that's on the menu tonight.
If only we could have the fresh, lovely summer to go with it. That was Michael McGrath, co-owner of Marylebone favourite The Providors, talking to Anna Franca about what's on his menu tonight, just around the corner from Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 tagat ya.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e yokoso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And that's all for tonight's edition of Midori House. Thanks very much to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Alex Jakes. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Menu. Here's a taste of what's in store.
It is, in fact, the only self-proclaimed gastronomic restaurant in Afghanistan. Everything is homemade in the kitchen, from the foie gras to the dessert of macaroons served with the ice cream on the side.
In 3 hours from right now, that's about 2200 hours here in London, I'll be back for the Monocle Daily with Tom Burgess Watson. But for the moment, thanks very much for listening. Good evening.